Welcome to today's episode of the Ideonomics podcast, where we talk about inclusion, diversity, equity, accessibility, and anti-racism in the Canadian Public Service. I'm your co-host, Neha Shahzad Chandrarajan, joining you from Ottawa, which is the land of the unceded and unsurrendered territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe peoples.
And I'm your co-host for today, Vishala Shebidesi. I work at the CBSA as the Culture Ambassador for the Commercial and Trade Branch. I'm also an executive member of the Women's Advisory Committee, the Racialized Persons Advisory Committee, and the Branch EDI Steering Committee. I'm located in the city now known as Toronto, which is the traditional unceded territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples.
Today we are joined by Dr. Blair L. M. Kelly, award-winning historian and author, and she has a groundbreaking book out called Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, which is already out, and it spans 200 years of history, both of her family and the American working class. Hi, Blair. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Blair, I'm wondering if you can give us an introduction to Blair Kelly. What is your background? What got you started in this work?
I was born in New Jersey, but all of my ancestors are Southern. I went to undergrad at University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and then I went to graduate school at Duke. I moved to North Carolina and been here since then. I've worked at NC State for 20 years as a historian, a public historian, an oral historian, and I'm just starting a new position this year, this January past, at UNC Chapel Hill, where I am the Joel R. Williamson Professor of Southern Studies and the Director of the Center for the Study of the American South.
To start off, I'd like to get to know a little bit about the background of this book. Take us back to how and why you got started on this journey of looking into your own family history.
So I think it's twofold. I've been looking into my family history for a long time. My mother was very interested in talking about our past and teaching me that, you know, as I grew up. And so as I became a historian, thinking about that family history was really at the heart of how I thought about the African-American experience in the United States. I was approached by my editor, who was interested in a history of the Black working class. And at first I was like, well, I don't, you know, do labor and unions and that kind of thing. I thought about my family and I thought about the genealogy work I had been doing along with the research and the stories that I had been hearing my whole life. And so I just brought those into the conversation along with the research that I did on others and oral histories and newspaper accounts and really tried to create a personal story, but one that really touches so many people's experience with being working class in the United States.
That's fantastic. I know in the book you talk about enslaved blacksmiths to essential workers of the COVID-19 pandemic. So I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of details as to who you explore.
I start with my ancestor in the introduction, Solicitor Duncan, who was an agricultural worker. He was a sharecropper, and he had to take my grandfather and his siblings and his wife and flee sharecropping in Georgia because of the awful conditions they were facing and the inequities and wage theft, basically, that they were suffering. And so that's where I begin the story. I go back to enslavement. I'm tracing my farthest back ancestor on that family line, Henry, who was enslaved and was a blacksmith, I discovered in the course of my research. Those were stories I did not know growing up. They really came from my genealogical research and digging into the family that owned him and held him in bondage and tracing his life after freedom. And that bit of history really come to life with my research. Then I also talk about washerwomen, women who wash clothes, you know, before the advent of the washing machine, women had to make soap and boil water and hang clothes on lines and make their own starch. And iron was something that was actually a piece of iron rather than the sort of plastic and steel thing that we use today. And so my great grandmother did that work, and I discovered along the way. But it's been something that's been interesting to me throughout the time I've been a historian, there's a really amazing book called To Join My Freedom by a Princeton historian, Tara Hunter, that I had read in graduate school. So washerwomen had been of interest to me all along. So thinking about women's work in particular, work that most people considered unskilled, but I don't. I think tremendous skill in their labor. And to really amplify their ability to organize and to be mobile and to take care of their own families, but also to really create a vision of what citizenship should mean for Black people. Then I also talked about Pullman porters. These were Black men who waited on train passengers on interstate trains in after enslavement. A man named George Mortimer Pullman thought of this idea of a sleeping car that would be very luxurious and provide a comfortable ride for people riding for days on the train, where the daytime sleeping berth would be transformed into a nighttime sleeping area from a seat to a sleeper, as he pictured should have been happening in the antebellum South. He himself was a guy from New York State, so I don't know how he visioned this, but he decided that was the model that he wanted to use. So he hired mostly Black workers. On the West Coast, there were some Filipino men who also were hired as Pullman porters. But for the most of the country, it was an all-Black workforce. And so they ended up forming the first all-Black private union, partly because they had been rejected by the all-white, tremendously important in civil rights history and organizing for Black workers across the board, not just in their own field. I also talk about my grandmother's journey migrating north and ending up becoming a maid, a living domestic for a family. It wasn't the work she wanted to do, but it was the work that was the only work that was available to Black women at the time in Philadelphia and a lot of other places. And then I also talked about postal workers and the challenge that Black workers had in getting access to something that we now associate very deeply with Black American work. It's the only kind of working class labor delineated in the American Constitution. And so it's really was an interesting battleground, not only for access to good jobs, but also a deeper sense of citizenship.
It's crazy how all of these really hard manual labor work became the foundation for some of these battles, like you said. And yes. I love how you say that the women's work in particular was unskilled, or a lot of people think it was unskilled, yes. But obviously it takes so many resources to be able to pull that together, yes. Especially probably with your grandmother of becoming a maid, a domestic live-in. It takes so much work.
I don't think anybody's unskilled who does a job. If you spend time, you get trained, you have to cultivate your skill over time. This notion of being unskilled or skilled, I think, is a way to demean certain workers. So it's a concept I pick apart, I think, in Black folk.
That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you were able to do that deep dive into your personal history. Generally, historians, they have to take an objective approach in their research, and it's something that's detached from them. How did other historians perceive your book?
Well, I don't know. I mean, everyone so far has said nice things to my face. But, you're right. When I was in graduate school, you were dissuaded from studying your own family. They call it like a mystery, that you would be not a real objective historian. But here I'm combining, my family stories with archival research and census records and wills, newspapers, all different kinds of documents. And so I'm not theorizing based on my family. I'm using my family as a jumping off point to talk about these larger dynamics. And I think it's important that we get away from this notion that, the histories we write about shouldn't have anything to do with us. I think all writing is political and engaged. And I feel very committed to folks that we can't relate to. And I think that's why so many people shy away from history and think of it as boring. But for me, I see history in everyday living, and I want to teach that to others and model that for the world, because I think we have so much to learn from everyday people in our past. I think my family's exceptional because, they're my family, but I think they're common. And I think they're there as a way and a means to explore a broader
because you were looking at your personal history, did this make it a more challenging endeavor for you?
I think everything I work on has that more challenging dimension. As a person who studies the African-American experience, you have to get comfortable with things that are uncomfortable and histories that are dealing with subjugation and the folks who suffered through it, but then, you know, some who found their way. But for me, it was a challenge to look at my actual family. You know, to find Henry was really touching. I found him, I believe, in the slave schedules of the man who held him in bondage. Slave schedules were part of the census, so they would delineate you along with the furniture and the value of the land and things like that. So they would go through the house and say what those things were worth, and then they would count each enslaved person, often not by name. So his name doesn't appear in those documents. He appeared in the U.S. Census as a free man, listed as mulatto along with his family, and had his age, and the age was pretty consistent over the census in his lifetime. So I found a mulatto slave identified in the slave schedules and his slaveholder's will as well, which again, you know, my good objective historical training taught me that most people who held large numbers of people in bondage, over 200 people in bondage, aren't listing those people by name in kind of will or document like that. So something in my spirit was pushing me to read the will anyway, and it was manuscript. And I felt like, I know his name is not there. You're going to get disappointed. But I just read it anyway, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And there his name appeared in there listed as a blacksmith. And it was extraordinary joy I had in that moment of really finding him. But then I noted that his family wasn't listed there, his children, his wife. And I wondered, you know, if that will had been executed, what would have happened to his family? Would he have been separated from them or sold away from them or kept away from them? Unfortunately, that will was not executed. His slaveholder died at the moment during the Civil War. And so I believe that he probably got his freedom before that will was fully actualized. Then I also found him registering to vote in 1867, just 3 years after the owner dies and he 2 years after freedom. And of course, he can't sign his name because the enslaved were not allowed by law to learn to read or write. But there's an X there on the line, and above it, it's written his mark. The bravery that it would have taken to register to vote in those circumstances with the Klan really threatening violence all around that area. It really touched me to see those few documents that I do have of his experience.
I could see this being a docuseries called Finding Henry. I was wondering the same thing as Vishala about the emotional impact that it would take to go through each ancestor and figure out, is this the ancestor that I'm looking for, and go through all these vague documents because slaves were just considered so much part of property.
Yeah. I learned a lot about the approach of the enslaver in those periods. But, you know, it's so personal just to think that someone like me, who looked like me or sounded like me, was going through these really hard things. But, you know, sharing that with our readers and doing that kind of work is what historians are supposed to be doing, to really enable people to understand the degree to which we're talking about humans and we're talking about their dreams and desires. But for me, starting in slavery is unusual for a history of work. Oftentimes we think of the working class as something that can only exist in freedom, if I was a strict Marxian, right? But learning the community of care, the ethics, the faith that the enslaved built helps to explain as free people, in spite of the terrible circumstances and the difficulties they continue to face. So if I didn't start there, I don't feel like you get to the root of the story.
Since you probably had so many family trees to go through, how did you choose to highlight some ancestors over the other? I mean, some had naturally very interesting stories, like the Pullman Porter formed the first all-Black union, or Henry was a bit of a mystery that was to be solved, or your grandmother. But for the other ancestors, I wonder, what method did you use?
So I don't have an ancestor for every chapter. I have a lot of really great oral histories where I try to create that same kind of intimacy and sense of personhood that I did for my own ancestors. And I found some phenomenal interviews. I built trees for those people too. I literally have 26 trees in ancestry. I loved, you know, if I found a great interview, I would just pop a tree and see like, okay, can I find this person? Can I find their family? And one of my favorite ones was my washerwoman, Sarah Hill. So not a relative of mine, but her story to me was so compelling. And the image of her working in her yard and having this white woman from the government come around and ask her questions and inspect her things felt like an interesting and weird moment. So I wanted to talk about the power that she would have had as a washerwoman, but also the ways in which this government worker's encroachment on her, what that must have been like. I was drawn to it, and then I could make a tree for her, and she happened to be from Elbert County, which was where Henry was from. And so it was this amazing string that I just felt like, oh, wow. For me, I kept finding these amazing connections that made everything make sense. The maid that I write about, a woman named Minnie, migrated as a teenager. She ran away from her folks to move to Philadelphia, and she ended up becoming a maid. It happened to be from the place where my grandfather was born in Accomack County, and where my ancestors are from, in the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And so I was like, there's another beautiful connection. They left probably on the same exact train. There's only one train that left, and they probably left within 2 years of each other as teenagers. And so that parallel, of course, was so compelling. There were just things like that that kept popping up in the stories over and over again that made me feel connected and guided toward the people that I picked. So I feel like they picked me more than I picked them.
That's great. I want to just switch to the agriculture piece. In your book, you talk a little bit about your grandfather's sweet potatoes and the agriculture methods he used.
My grandfather was from Accomack County, Virginia. It happened to be a hub of sweet potato growing for the whole East Coast, sweet and white potatoes, but he was very fond of sweet potatoes. So his grandfather was the one that really trained him and taught him how to cultivate potatoes from little slips and get the vines in hot boxes and grow them over time for himself. So when he came and migrated to Philadelphia, he kept growing potatoes. He had a victory garden during the Second World War on some land that was provided by the city. Then after the war was over, he didn't have that land anymore. And so he found somebody who was from his home county in Accomack that had land in South Jersey. And so he would get on the bus first thing on Saturday mornings with my dad. They would go to Pennsauken, New Jersey. And there, that man just let him use some of his fields. And that's where he grew food. But then he would bring all the stuff that they were growing back to North Philadelphia and just distribute it to the neighborhood without charge and just share the food that he grew. And my dad was always like, you could sell this. And he was like, no, that's not the point. I mean, people need food. And so he was very interested in my dad learning it just as a way of empowering and passing that knowledge that had come through the family down over time. And he loved the sweet potatoes in his own house and kept a bunch and string them up until they would get really ripe and golden. And I talk about his just deep knowledge and love of where he's from. And we oftentimes think about what people don't have. But when we think about like the sweet potato from my grandfather or other bits of cultural knowledge that people carry with them as they go through the world, people always have something. They have something of themselves. They have something of where they're from that they carry forward.
That's incredible. Since you started talking about your father, I'm wondering now what your family thought of you going back into the history. And when you were teasing out some of these stories, what was their reaction?
I think they've been really excited. My father is 89 and he's dealing with, you know, a lot of the memory issues. Mm-hmm. But he was great with remembering that past and remembering those details. I mean, that all was very sharp. I think he was really glad and excited to share that. My mom passed away. I think she's excited wherever she is. Because, you know, I definitely felt always connected to her. And she was really that first giver of history. She was a school teacher and always wanted me to know the history. So most of my ancestors that I talk about in the book are gone. But I think the family that's still here is quite proud.
It sounds like an amazing piece of work. And I can't wait to get into it deeper.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ideanomics podcast. We hope it was enjoyable for you, as it was for us. For more anti-racism news, please follow us on our social media channels, on Twitter, @ARAN_PS, and our LinkedIn, Anti-Racism Ambassadors Network.
If you would like us to discuss any topics on the podcast, or if you have any questions, please DM us on our social channels or email us at aran.publicservants@gmail.com.
This episode was hosted by Neha Shahzad Chandarajan and Vishala Shambidesi. This episode was also edited by Vishala Shambidesi. Please look out for part 2 of our conversation with Blair L. M. Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us today.